He's a magna cum laude graduate of Brandeis University, and he earned his Doctor of Ministry degree, which you all might think about doing at some point in your lives, from Wesley Theological Seminary. And he has worked at the RAC, at Camp Ramah in New England. He's done work for CLAW, and is bio your student pulpit in St. Croix, USVI.
Someone had to do it.
Yeah. But he's active. He is chair of COGIL. You all know about COGIL. Well, you better for you to tell them about COGIL. And it's my pleasure to welcome you, and I'm excited to learn.
Thank you. And it's a delight to be here. But needless to say, though, all the denominational boundaries are you know, bupkis at this point, and we're all learning and teaching and sharing and growing together as it should be. And yeah, the deep roots in the Reform world as well, nifty, misty, all that. So really spectacular to be here. COGIL, Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life, COEJL.org. Is the umbrella organization that was founded in 1993 to as a project of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which is the kind of umbrella public policy body for the broader American Jewish community. The JCPA, for those who may not be familiar with the alphabet soup of American Jewry, this is actually, is there a course in this?
In the alphabet soup. There
really should be. and that's one where the seminaries could all get together, right? All the acronyms, right? Because this is where both the local Jewish community relations councils that represent the grassroots in every community, but also the grass tops, the national organizations, including the URJ and the parallels in the Orthodox Union, the Conservative and the Reconstructionist, but also Hadassah, National Council of Jewish Women, AJC, the other AJC, When It's Alive, ADL, like all those. If it's an alphabet soup, it's in there. And JCPA takes public policy positions on behalf of the American Jewish community and does lobbying and advocacy and education. And COGIL is the environmental wing of that. And at times it's been more independent, and at times it's been more really working within the JCPA structure. That's where we are now. But what it means is that the bodies of American Judaism, including separately the URJ, the CCAR, I believe that the Women of Reform Judaism is now a separate seat at the JCPA table, I think, and HUC itself are all signatories to this broad coalition. The most important is the Religious Action Center, which has long been right behind JCPA as actually doing this work. And I literally, on the street while I was putting the finishing touches on today's shiur, after my train got in, I ran into the former RAC legislative assistant, who's now studying at the Wagner School, Rachel Cohen. Some of you may know her. Anyway, old friend. That was really cool. So important work is being done. It's being done in the name of the URJ and in the name of the CCAR and of HUC, and that's very exciting and very important. There's also a lot of resources to be shared from across the broader community. So that's a little context. Helpful? Okay. As a movement, by the way, the only thing older than COGIL in 1993, along with the early beginnings of the Teva Learning Center, which is now part of Chazon, though Chazon came later, the only thing older was Shomrei Adama, the sort of first grassroots Jewish environmental group that was founded in 1987, 1988, by Ellen Bernstein in the basement of RRC in Philadelphia, as it happens. That sort of got things going. I like to think of it as it broke up the clods of earth so that COGIL could plant the seeds, and now Chazon and all these other organizations are watering and nurturing, and now there's a whole ecosystem. It's really an amazing history. And I had the dumb luck of being a Jewish student leader in the late 80s. So I was at Shomrei Adama's founding conference, and I was on the ground floor of COGIL just because of being the right age. Could have been any of you. So I've had the incredible fortune of going all the way through rabbinic school and all through my avocational rabbinate years of focusing on eco-theology and environmental practice as much as possible as kind of my core other ministry, rabbinate, however you want to frame it. So I love sharing this stuff, and that's what it is. It's sharing, which means it's a two-way street. One of the people I've been privileged to meet along the way is Rabbi Everett Gendler. So I'm curious how many people have met or studied with Everett? No? So a living legend. He was so many firsts that I can't count them. But for our purposes, I believe he was the first rabbi in the modern period to really talk about farming and gardening as a spiritual practice, and to link doing agriculture, like Aleph Daled Gordon style, get your you know, fingernails dirty with Adama, as an actual piece of spiritual identity. Others have built on that, but he really got that going. His shul was his community at a prep school. He was also the first rabbi on staff of a prep school in history. It was Choate or one of those academies in Danny. And he put in the first solar-powered Ner Tamid. And this was like 1971. We're talking whole earth catalog solar, not like all these cheap PV cells from China, right? You had to go so seriously out of your way to make this happen. And he did. And the symbolism of it, when you think about it, right? Shemesh is actually not Tamid. We know that it only has about 5 billion years left. And, you know, too bad for our descendants. But it's the closest thing we can get to eternal light. And the idea that you can thumb your nose at Con Ed and say, no brown electricity, dirty coal mix for me to light my holy light. It's just so logical. So now, with the help of groups like Interfaith Power and Light, lots of organizations can qualify for retrofits. You can put PV cells. I'm thinking this, I mean, there's potential even here for as much shading as there is, but you've got a bunch of hours a day and it's underutilized. It's a thought. There's some amazing new finance mechanisms for nonprofits, which I'd be happy to brainstorm. But he got that going. And he also was the first, or one of the first voices in the 60s and early 70s, to begin to reappropriate the, some would call it pagan, and some would call it broader Near Eastern, and some would call it earth-based spirituality, but the antecedents of Judaism. So most of you know the poet Shaul Chernyakhovsky, most famous for Sachki, Sachki, Laugh at All My Dreams, right? Set many times, and some say that should be the Israeli national anthem instead of Hatikva. That's another story. But he has this beautiful poem, which I learned first from Everett Gendler. He kind of brought it back, and now it's out there a lot. But he's Chernyakhovsky, who was the kind of pagan poet of the early Hebrew Renaissance, just after Bialik, sort of 20s through 40s were his active period. And he talks about, in the face of Mishnah Avot, there's this one Mishnah that some people say is anti-environmental. I don't know if you're familiar with this one. It says, Kol HaMafsek at Talmud, you know, Talmud Ato, whatever. Like, anyone who interrupts their learning to say, Mana e ilanzo, Mana e nirzo. To look around and say, how beautiful is that tree? How beautiful is that plowed field? Ma'ale alav hakatuv ke'ilu, you know, scripture considers it as if he had forfeited his soul, right? And the pro-environmental reading of that, that Jeremy Benstein and others have done, says the actionable offense is saying that your Talmud and your admiration of the beautiful tree are separate. If you draw the separation, then you have cut off the roots of your vital identity. So it's not that Talmud is more important than nature appreciation, it's that you need to link the two consistently. But in the face of that, Chernyakhovsky writes about that striking fir tree and that beautiful plowed field, and goes on to say, this is where we see the image of God. So he, who was a Talmid Chacham, but a Chiloni poet, is taking those ingredients of the tradition and doing this amazing tikkun and saying, precisely the places where it seemed that the rabbis were trying to put the kibosh on anything pagan, on anything that's appreciating the beauty of the natural world, we are going to bring that back. And we are going to celebrate it, and we are going to be so radical in doing so that we will even alter Bereishit Aleph in our estimation and say it's no longer simply that Nivra B'Tselem Elohim, that humanity is created in the image of God. The image of God needs to be seen in all of creation. We need to re-sacralize creation. So Chernikovsky does this in the 30s and 40s, but it was not known in English and not known in American Judaism until the late 60s. Everett Gendler brought that here and put his own stamp on it. So in a Gendlerian way, this is just the opener to set the stage. We're going to look at one text, and then we'll eat and do all the other stuff that was promised and wrap up before noon. Looking up and squinting, how many things do you recognize on this roof? Like from a distance, just the logos, the colors, right? We live in this material universe, and we can see Crest from Colgate at 50 paces, right? Right. So name a couple of the things that you can identify specifically on the roof. Nice. Staples, nice.
Strings.
Strings.
The places where the branch pokes through from the stock.
The sky belongs. Like group things of the different products of plastic bags.
The obligatory fake fruit, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, did you say spruce?
Skach.
Yeah, you said skach. Okay. So, I believe it's hemlock, which is a cousin of spruce. But what's amazing is we know our speed stick from our right guard and our crest from our Colgate, but we don't necessarily know our hemlock from our Douglas fir, right? And there is such a paucity of the real knowledge, right? Which one would we say more accurately reflects? If we were going to extend the image of God to non-human creation, right? Would it be brands of toothpaste, or would it be species of trees? Right, but unless we make the radical countercultural choice to immerse ourselves in that, we have to go out of our way to learn one tree from another. We don't have to go out of our way, products of the larger culture that we are, to know one product from another. And essentially, this kind of Everett Gendlerian Jewish environmentalism is the antidote to what is so wrong with the broader society. He says, go out of your way. Study nature the way you study Torah, and make a consistent linkage between the two. So it is so appropriate that we are here in the spirit of Everett Gendler, and just honored to do anything that has his name on it. Can we pass out the one that says Sukkot? So we're going to do a quick chevruta on a text, because I know that the main frame for the Gendler initiative here is around food systems. And it raises so many vital questions. Where does our food come from? Where does the waste go to? All of those issues, and they're addressed here. When we look at this particular block at 4th and Broadway, there's not a lot that you can do to address the larger food production system, but I wouldn't rule it out. You've got a lot of room here, a lot of sun. You probably could not make it a full green roof because that requires extra, you know, someone could talk to the engineers who know the building and maybe it's possible. But with the sedum layer and, you know, it holds a lot of water. But container gardens, this is incredible. There is such potential here. And similarly, we talked about doing some light composting on site is possible too, with one of those urban compost, a tumbler kind of thing. And with people who are devoted to making it happen, there is room here. This is an underutilized resource of the Reform Jewish community, this roof. I've been in this building a lot. I've never been up here. And it's amazing and could be put to much fuller use. And because it's outside, because it gets all this great direct sun, we're thinking about. So the opening text isn't necessarily directly connected to Sukkot, except that Sukkot is an agricultural holiday. And it's not necessarily connected to the Eco-Judaism 101 when I thought I had 1 hour to kind of, you know, share a little bit of everything. But this felt like a very appropriate text, partly because it references a Hallel that we didn't sing today, but it's in there in the Hallel 2 in the Mishkan Tefillah. So let's do this Kekvutza. The context is here. It's the opening of Perek Vav of the Mishnah. And it will all be familiar if you've never studied this text. You will still recognize if you scan the Mishnah, right? Mevarchim al ha-perot, al ha-perot ha-ilan, hu omer borei pri ha-etz. Chutz min ha-yayin, shal ha-yayin, hu omer borei pri ha-gafen. This is all very familiar, except for the last one, where Rabbi Yehuda suggests that instead of borei pri ha-adama, you can say borei minei desaim, right? Deshe from Genesis chapter 1, the description of the kind of verdant undergrowth. Right? It's distinct from tree, but it raises that question. You know, I always wonder, like, if you go pick a wild blackberry, right, or something like that, right? You're taking it from a bush. It's not a tree, but it's also not adama exactly. And so, again, when you know where your food comes from, it raises the interesting questions about this. What I wanted to look at was the broader question of kind of ownership. What is our relationship to the created world? And clearly, we have to use it, right? Clearly, it is appropriate to take what was dirt and make bricks out of it so that there are buildings, to take what once was a tree and make a lattice work out of it so that we have a roof for our sukkah. But how much we use and which raises a whole host of questions. Same with the food system. So the last two lines in the larger type at Amar Rav Yehuda. Does someone want to give this a try? Yeah, third line from the bottom where I made it larger script because this is the relevant passage. Thank you.
אמר רב יהודה, אמר שמואל, כל הנהנה מן העולם הזה ולא ברכה, כאילו נהנה מקדשי שמיים.
Yep.
שנאמר, אדוני הארץ ומלואו, רב לוי, רמי, כתיב לאדוני הארץ ומלואו, וכתיב השמיים, שמיים לאדוני, והארץ נתן לבני אדם, לא כאשר.
Nice. Okay. Excellent. Most people tracked most of this, right? So two famous lines from Tehillim that seem to be in direct opposition to each other. But it begins with this larger question. Obviously, the thrust of this passage is the Mishnah is what bracha should you say? And then the broader question is, how important is it that you say a bracha? How important is it that you don't take your sustenance for granted? That's the bottom line question. And this is one of those places where I think for us as liberal Jews, there is such potential to connect. People want meaning, right? They may not want halacha, they may not want the traditional, the bracha bee, you know, again, like which kind of berry gets which kind of bracha according to Shulchan Aruch, But the broader notion that we should not simply partake, but stop and reflect and appreciate, ties in with every good, thoughtful trend in broader society. It's still countercultural in the sense that it's a consumer society, and we are there's an instant gratification thing that goes with modernity. But all the hip, fun, progressive, thoughtful, eco, green, young, millennial, you know, etc., fill in the blank, people want meaning. And so this broader question, not which bracha do you say, but what does it mean to approach consumption from a stance of gratitude and inquiry, appreciative inquiry of where did this come from, what does it mean, who else is implicated, what are the systems that I'm touching through this berry, this shirt, this lumber, etc. So if you enjoy something from this world without saying a blessing, it's as if you have taken from the Kodshei Shamayim. And this gets to all the technicalities of Hekdesh, right? When you bring your produce and you declare it, right, after you have tithed it, but before it is consumed, it's sitting in a granary somewhere in Jerusalem, essentially, but it is marked for God. It is no longer out there available in the marketplace, right? So it is Hekdesh. It has been made holy, sanctified, set apart, right? All that root of Kadosh as separate and distinct. But effectively, it now belongs to God. And so the short version of this is if you eat without saying a bracha, you are stealing from God. That's the upshot of this within the halachic system. And then there's the question, because the proof text, of course, is L'Adonai ha'aretz umlo'o. Psalm 24, verse 1, the earth is God's and the fullness thereof. Where, curious if folks know in broader social movements, 20th century, where did this passage, the earth is God's and the fullness thereof, where did it resonate?
Woodstock?
Nice.
Is that creation care?
Certainly the creation care movement. Woodstock, you got the year right. It was 1969 when this stuff got going, but it was Earth Day, very good, that was 1970. And this still, people had not yet made this connection so much. There was a little literature in the early 70s on Judaism and environment. Norman Lamb, Eric Freudenstein, a few people. And then it kind of lay fallow till the mid-80s and this rebirth. But yeah, people weren't so much drawing that connection. Think south of the equator.
Organics,
good.
Liberation theology.
Thank you. Liberation theology. One of exactly, right. So true, a lot of it was Central America, which is still north of the equator. But for those who don't know, Gustavo Gutierrez and people like that who, starting around 68, 69, began to articulate some amazing theology within the Catholic Church that emphasized liberation, right? That emphasized the preferential option for the poor, all this great language that we really should know. It's part of kind of a Western theological discourse. And if there is one pasuk that they came back to over and over, it was this, which traditionally, where is this in our liturgy, by the way? You know, anything that's greatest hits gets somewhere in the Siddur or Machzor.
What is it? It's a Hakafah for festival.
It's the Torah return on festivals, instead of Havu L'Adonai B'nei Elim, Psalm 29, which is the standard recessional for Shabbat, for Yom Tov, it is Psalm 24. So it's in there. It's one of those things that the tradition said, oh, this is not just any old psalm. This is really important. We want to put it in a place where people hear it multiple times through the year and really get it. So in liberation theology, this pasuk says, the earth is God's. So whose isn't it?
Oh,
ours, but specifically in that context, right? Why is it so important to assert the divine ownership of everything?
It's not a dictator. It's not a...
It does not belong to the junta. It does not belong to the foreign corporations. I'm sorry to say many of them American with CIA involvement, right? That helped to bring about the economic, political, social realities that these folks were dealing with. The earth does not belong to the gringos. The earth does not belong to the ruling elite, the junta. The earth belongs to God, and we are all God's children, and we are all created in the divine image. In God's eyes, we're equal. And so you can then see the proto-socialism of that world as well. Kind of, okay, so let's divide things fairly among God's children if the earth is God's, as opposed to saying the earth belongs to those corporations who have some deed enforced by the military junta that this belongs to them and we all work for them. So it has incredible resonance for a broad swath of the larger world. And it is, for us, I would submit, necessary in a very similar way. And without getting, you know, you can't talk about this stuff without getting political, but Citizens United, right? The Supreme Court decision that treats corporations as entities and allows unlimited campaign spending is one of those examples of a cutting-edge issue in the broader discourse where Jewish values have something to say. And if the earth is God's and the fullness thereof, and we learn from what our Catholic friends in Central and South America did with that pasuk, then it actually becomes a rallying cry for us about acknowledging the importance of an equitable distribution of resources among God's children. And then if you add Shaul Chernikovsky, it's not just among God's children, it's also among all of creation. Because the broader environmental question is, even if we could make sure that everybody had electricity and running water and decent health care, and we're not anywhere near there, but if we did, even at the current 7 billion people, we are beyond the carrying capacity of the planet without squeezing out so many other species. They're becoming extinct by the day, not out of malice, but out of a willingness to let it happen. We know, but we don't do enough to stop it. We know that the products that we make, the heavy metals that are in our cell phones and tablets, and the cotton in our shirts, and the food that comes, you know, because you can go to Fairway Market or whatever, and you can get amazing produce from Chile or from New Zealand any time of the year. Fresh, bright, amazing. But what's the carbon footprint of that? Those kinds of questions... That there's a nice link between Kermit the Frog and our great-grandparents, right? Is this becoming clear? As I'm kind of painting a picture of how hard it is to ask all these questions and to realize all these implications, right? Zushter sein a Yid. It's tough to be a Jew, right? But Kermit the Frog said, it ain't easy being green. And it's very much the same idea. Because in a sense, being green means asking these questions. And it is precisely the spirit of Talmudic inquiry. It is precisely the awareness of the interconnection of everything that is sort of essential. Judaism is also essential environmentalism. And people would rather not go there. It's tough to be a Jew, so a lot of people don't affiliate. It ain't easy being green, so a lot of people don't identify that way and choose the ostrich route. But as Jewish leaders who are schooled not just in this, in the specifics of Talmudic inquiry, but in its method and its purpose, this is the best application that we can give it. Where it's not about what is written necessarily in Talmud Brachot 35a and b, right? But the broader questions. So, all that was L'Adonai Haaretz Umlo'o, the earth is God's, but wait a minute. Hashamayim Shamayim L'Adonai V'Haaretz Natan Livnei Adam. Right? So, the heavens, fine, that's God's, but God gave the earth to human beings. Haaretz Natan Livnei Adam. It says it right there in Hallel. So, how is this possible? The earth is God's in Psalm 24, but by the time you get to Psalm 115, God has given it away. Whose is it? Right. And that's the, right, Lakashya. It's not hard. It's not actually, you know, they set it up as an opposition, but there's an easy terutz, there's an easy way of reconciling it. And the answer is saying a bracha. The answer is pausing to reflect, showing your appreciation, and even in the rabbinic system, stopping to think not only that I'm enjoying God's bounty, but which kind of bounty am I enjoying? Remember, this is on the Mishnah that's asking the question of ground versus tree versus bush, and what's the right bracha to say based on where it came from. And that is precisely what the food system of Lower Manhattan needs. The ultimate, in a sense, is the ultimate environmental living, right? You don't need a car, public transit. Almost everyone is only exposed to the elements so that they're leaking heat or air conditioning out of their unit from one wall out of six, right? Because you're sharing in these apartment buildings, as opposed to the houses that so many of us grew up in, where you leak on five out of six sides, everything except below. Think the axis of you know, lulav shaking, right? There is so much that is environmental about this kind of living. The danger is the deep, deep disconnect to stop and remember that it's not hamotzi lechem min hachanut, it's hamotzi lechem min haaretz. And when all you see is store and you don't see much aretz, that's hard. And that's necessary. And that's the spirit of, I would submit, this passage. So with that said, that feels like a good introduction to lunch, so that we say a bracha. And just for those who are able to stay, we have another, 20 minutes or so. And I'm going to pass out some kind of eco-Judaism resources and spin very fast through them so that you know what's where. And I realize there's some deep knowledge and some newer to it, and we'll all be on the same page, 20 minutes and a plate full of food later. Thank you for naming it. That was Lisa saying that there's an environmental and economic overlap, and sometimes it's only easy to be green for those who have the resources. And that's part of why introducing liberation theology, part of why introducing those questions about
the irony,
equitable...
The reverse, in our world.
So thank you for going there. And don't forget that we are not even 3 weeks into Shnat Shemitah. And this incredible focus on Shemitah, this cycle, is so exciting. And I can't wait to see what happens when people like us who are now getting exposed to the conversations are in leadership positions 7 years from now, and what we can do with Shemitah consciousness, because that's where the rubber meets the road on all these questions. Shemitah specifically says your private property ain't worth jack, and... Right. Once the produce is out there in the field, it's there for everyone. And once it's no longer available in the field, you have to open your basement. You have to open your pantry, and bring out all your pickled beets. Right. The moment that beets are not freely available in the field, then, you know, the moment that anyone could go hungry, you do not own your stuff anymore. It is a deep critique of the capitalist notion. I don't know the society is ready for it, but it's in the Torah. It's good stuff. So thank you.
Lunch, it's right out here. Just grab something and come back.
Okay. All right. And happy to schmooze during lunch. Take a break.
Look
out. Right.